Welcome to CBS Sports Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore. You can find me on Twitter, at MattMooreCBS, or at HP Basketball. You can find James Herbert, who's joining me right now, at Outside the NBA. We are going to talk about Wizards Celtics today. We are going to talk about Jazz Warriors today. We are going to save all of our conversations on tonight's Game 2s is being recorded on Wednesday afternoon. I'm going to go to Spurs Rockets after a while. Cavs and Raptors. Well, the Raptors are getting ready to lose another game to the Cavs here in a little bit. So, and we'll talk about those tomorrow. I did want to say, though, I have an idea. I know we're not going to talk about this, but I had an idea.
Okay.
Let's do... Why don't we do this? What if DeRozan puts... What if they use the guard as the screener? So, who in your opinion, has Kyrie been checked on most in the series so far? Like, who is he guarding?
I mean, he's guarding Kyle, usually.
Right. So use Kyle as a screener and try and force a switch to get DeRozan on, get Irving on DeRozan.
Yeah. I was surprised they didn't do that more, honestly. Like, they do that. They do that against Steph every time they play the Warriors. They try to get him on DeRozan. So I think part of it is just, like, you already have, like, Kyrie Irving guarding Kyle Lowry, so they can exploit that, right? Like, they can – there were a few times where he just took him, and you didn't really see that happen in the Milwaukee series. But, yeah, I mean – I think generally when Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love on the court, like you're attacking both of those guys as much as you can.
Yeah, and that's what they should do. So that's something that they should probably run more of. Anyway, that was my big thought. So, okay, the big story from last night on Tuesday is obviously Isaiah Thomas, who put in one of the most amazing performances contextually, given, you know, it was his sister's birthday, for crying out loud, and he had oral surgery the last 2 days, like 4 hours and then 5 hours. He pours in 20 in the fourth quarter, 29 between the fourth and overtime, leads a comeback out. It was an unbelievable performance from Isaiah Thomas. I have not been a guy that has been like, Isaiah Thomas is like a top five player in this league, but he is unbelievable. He just took over that game, and I think he's probably won them the series.
I mean, maybe. I don't think this is over by any means. But the Wizards really, I think they thought they had that game. They believed they were going to take that game. And then Isaiah just ripped their hearts out. And I mean, not that Washington didn't have a chance. Like, they had two good looks in the final possession of regulation with the Wall mid-ranger and then the Beal one where he was totally open. So, like, the Wizards did have their chances. But Isaiah was incredible. And you know, the crazy thing about it to me is, like, I was watching it and I was amazed just like everybody, but I was also like, I've seen this before. Like, this is what he did in the regular season a bunch of times. He just did it again on a bigger stage and in the middle of, like, an unimaginable week and a half. And it's an incredible playoff story. It's the best performance we've seen in the playoffs so far by anyone. And it, like, to just see him take over the way he did on offense, like, so many times in the regular season, but to see him do it when, like, otherwise they would have lost that game and lost home court advantage. Like, he did it at the perfect time, and he made all the right reads and made some incredibly tough shots and had so much swagger and was jawing with the other team. And it was just, it was amazing.
I genuinely feel that the Wizards have been the better team in the series, and I genuinely feel that they have almost no shot of winning. Like, that is how quickly this is turned, because, you know, I was kind of thinking, when we get into the second round, I start scoring things kind of by quarter, like it's in boxing where who won the round, and I'm like, okay, like the Wizards won. I would say that the Wizards won, even with the comeback by the Celtics in the second quarter. I would still say that they won the first and second quarter of game one. And they won three quarters of game two, and it still was not enough. like they're 0-2 in this series. The Keith injury in game one obviously screwed things up, but you know they do not have the personnel right now, I think, to battle the Celtics, because they can't switch, and if you can't switch in this league, you're in real trouble. They need to blitz Thomas pretty aggressively in game three. They just need to blitz him and be like, anybody else is going to beat us. And this is where the Al Horford signing really comes into play. Because last year you could do that and it might have worked. But now, when he gets the ball to Horford, Horford can pass or can shoot. He's not going to drive much. He's not that mobile. But
he can drive a little bit, though. Like, he can do those plays off the short roll that, like, is what every team wants somebody to do when the little guy gets blitzed. And I don't mean the little guy. I mean, like, whichever little guy your team has that's getting double teamed on the perimeter.
Yeah, but, like,
he's just such a good decision maker out of that it changes their offense. And he's been doing that all year.
Yeah, and that's awesome. And I think that he's changing that around. I just mean, if they collapse on him, like, Al Horford's not going to finish, like, through contact, twisting layup. Like, that's just not his game. Like, it's just not. Like, sometimes he'll take that ball and he'll dunk on, like, a straight line if no one picks him up.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying he's not, like, super athletic, hyper, you know, versatile finisher. Like, he's a big man. And that's okay. Because I think he can kick to the guy on the outside. And his passing and shooting just makes him almost impossible, to guard. So they can't make those rotations, and they're getting whatever they want offensively. Like, the Celtics have these stretches where they lock down and play awesome defense, and then they have long stretches where the Wizards get whatever they want. Like, whatever they're looking for, they can get.
Part of it is also who's on the floor. Like, when the Wizards bench is on, or their second unit, it's never, like, really in this series, it's not like a full five-man bench unit, but, like, when they have their second unit on, then that's generally where the Celtics make runs, and that's where they actually get a bunch of stops in a row. And when it's been starters versus starters, the series has just been a shootout. I'd say that for both of the two games. And it's interesting because, like, when you say, like, you feel like the Wizards have been the better team, I think, like, maybe first five versus first five, but the whole time, like, when I'm watching the series, maybe this is just me because we've been talking about the bench for so long, but I'm always just like, all right, so how much of a cushion can this unit build before the start of the second quarter, before the start of the fourth quarter, or before that time, like a few minutes into the fourth quarter where John Wall gets his little rest and then comes back in? Like, how can they kind of cheat this so they don't get murdered when the Celtics have their bench on the court, or, like, their second unit, with a few starters? Like, that's kind of how I've seen this series. It's just like, yeah, if this was just first five versus first five, then the Wizards would be up to nothing, but that they're not.
Right. And this is interesting because I think you really value, I think, those benches more than I do, because I'm always like, well, you know, you're going to play short in rotations. But the Celtics really are. Like, they're getting contributions from 1 through 11. Like, everybody's helping. And that is going to be the difference in this series. It's why I think Boston's going to win now, is the Wizards are so bad, and no one is stepping up, not Bogdanovich, not Jennings. No one is stepping up for them to be able to even survive. And so the Celtics...
The Jennings thing is really, like, it's really gotten to a point where it's painful to watch. And, like, this is... Like, I'm a guy who's been a supporter of Jennings throughout his career, and, like, I do believe there's, like, if you look at his skill set, like, there is a role for a super quick point guard who's pass first and can, like, kind of annoy people with pressure defense and stuff like that. But, like, he's just been so off when it comes to decision making and shooting, and, like, defensively he's been getting roasted. Like, it's hard to watch right now. Like, they're bleeding points when he's on the court.
Yeah, and that's tough. I have hope for this Wizards core in the future. It's like, I did start thinking about that last night. Like, you know what, even if they lose the series, like, they've got Scott Brooks, who it's pretty clear does a great job with this.
Well, first, let's not write them off in this series. Like, they lost the two games in Boston. Like, they could, like, these have been close.
Yeah, I guess.
Like, they could win the next two, and then we're talking about this totally differently.
Yeah, but I just feel like this is just the Celtics' year. Like, this, like, they, you know, they were in a world of trouble versus the 8-seed Chicago Bulls. And then, like, the one guy that would really ruin them. Like, if Dwayne Wade had gotten hurt in that series, it would have done less damage to the Bulls than Rondo. That's insane. But that's, like, how the matchup worked out. And that guy goes down. Keith gets hurt in game one and wasn't 100% last night. And he wasn't going to stick with Thomas on that crossover anyway. But he just wasn't able to move. Now, Morris gave him good minutes, but he also couldn't go for, you know, as much as they needed him to because the ankle wasn't good enough. And it's just like, you know, Thomas goes for 53. You know, and for me, I look at my impulse is to be like, they needed 53 to win a game two at home as a one seed. Like, in a comeback, in a major comeback effort. And that to me is like, there's alarm bells going off, but I can't be like that. I have to be like, they have momentum, and they're just playing with a lot of confidence right now, and they're playing with emotion, and they're tucked into each other, and you know, for me, this 100% ends after this. Like all of these things really tell me is like, oh, they got no shot versus Cavs. Like they got zero chance versus the Cleveland Cavaliers. But you know, they're playing extremely well together, and hey, maybe that'll change. Maybe they'll be the team that finally exposes Cleveland and gets past it. And if they make the finals with the number one lottery spot and all this cap space this summer, I mean, you know, the sky's the limit for the Celtics team, and they could just keep adding great pieces and keep in contention. And maybe Isaiah Thomas is going to look at this the way we looked at Curry's rise in 2013 and be like, you know what? Isaiah Thomas is like a top five player in the NBA because that's just how, like, he's just able to score that much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, I've been kind of wrapping my mind around the Isaiah thing and trying to figure out, like, I think we talk about him in this, like, weird way where it's like we accept that he's a star, but there's still, like, some skepticism, not from everyone, but kind of like, well, how real is this or whatever? And I'm just like, I think it's just been real all along, man. Like, you can go back to his stats in Sacramento, and like I went back to some old interviews that I did with him. I remember I did a feature not even that long ago, like last year when he made his first All-Star appearance. I did a feature on him and Draymond as like the surprising All-Stars, if you will, or the unlikely All-Stars. And there's a quote from Isaiah saying like, you know, people just thought of me as this guy that's like scoring points on a bad team. I'm glad that's kind of going away. And then there's like a different quote from that same interview session where he was like, again, asked about like his perception and how people used to think that he should just be a bench player. And like Isaiah was sort of like, yeah, like hopefully that's gone, but I'm not sure. I'm sure there's still some people who think of me this way, despite the fact that he's like answering this question at an all-star media availability. Like he still had the sense that people hadn't quite fully accepted him as a star. And I think he's just been at every turn overlooked despite what his production is. And like, yeah, he's an imperfect player. But I think like you look around at a lot of all-stars and like they all have their flaws. And like Isaiah's defense is certainly a flaw, but I don't think it's something that necessarily has to hold his team back. I don't think it's something that they can't make up for. Like they made up for it enough to win what they won in the regular season. And I think the stuff that he does well, he does so damn well that the entire league hasn't been able to figure it out. And I think it says something that like, as he's emerged sort of in the way Steph did, like you were alluding to, like as he's gone from a guy who was just sort of thought of as like a scorer and a skilled guy to like, oh, this is the number one option on a really good team. And like defenses started planning for him above anybody else. And like his own coach started being like, all right, well, our fourth quarter offense is just going to revolve around you. Like you can shoot as much as you want. You can play make as much as you want. The fact that he's been able to keep up his efficiency is really telling. And I think that tells you that he's one of the elite playmakers and point guards in the NBA right now is like, he's basically been doing the same thing the entire time, but this year has been like fully empowered to do that as the number one guy, as somebody who's secure in his role and has his teammates' confidence that like they're not going to be annoyed if he just goes and gets his. And he was always a guy that was fearless. He was always a guy that throughout his entire career, back in college, everything would like go in and challenge bigger guys and not be afraid and talk trash to them. And I think the only difference is he's doing that more often. He's doing that on a winning team, and he's doing that now in the playoffs. And I think it's great to see. But part of me is also like, I don't know if this is like so much of like a breakout or if it's just like what he's always done. And that's interesting to me. And I'm trying to like figure out how to like explore that in a story that is like sort of half outlined and not really written. So I might be spoiling something that I'm writing, or I might not if I can't figure it out.
All of your stuff is like, we knew this all along. This is how you feel about like everything. It's like, we knew this all along with the Raptors. We knew this all along with this. DeMar DeRozan's always been this guy. Isaiah Thomas has always been this. And I'm very much like, no, this is new. Like, this is like, this is very much like not what we expected.
I don't think I'm always like that. I just think,
I would say also, here's part of my thing.
Like, look at his per 36 stats. Like, look at how efficient he's been for so long. While, like, scoring, like, I'm not, like, the confidence to me of him and of his teammates and his coaching staff is what's new. Like, he's in a different role, but he's been doing this. Like, he's been making those same plays. He made those same plays with the Kings. It's just they were in games that nobody was watching.
I don't agree. I don't think that he was the same guy. I think that he had some of the same moves and he did some of the same production, but I mean, like, you know, I mean, look, his third year in Sacramento, it was 21.1 per 36. He averaged 31 points per 36 this year. That's a 10-point jump. Like,
yeah, the usage went up this year. This was the year when he went wild.
And, I mean, he's shooting a career-high best, 46%. He shot 43% from the field last year, 41% in Boston in 2015 when he was a sixth man. He was shooting 40... he shot 42% in 2015 between the two teams. You know, he shot 36% from the field last year. He's up to... Or from three, he's up to 38. I mean, he's having career numbers across the board. He's shooting a career-high in free-throw percentage. His assists are actually kind of down from others, which isn't surprising given the role that he's adapted to on the offense. I just think that it's a little bit much to extrapolate that he's always been this guy. I think that he's at another level. It'll be interesting to see how long he's able to last there, and how whether or not, because I will say, like, we talk about this all the time, like, careers are linear, right? Like, aren't linear. Like, it's not like you just get better every single year. And so, like, we'll see kind of what happens. And to be quite honest, there is a little bit part of me that's because I'm in, like, Spurs-Rockets was a blowout, right? Like, just complete blowout. But even then, the level of execution just from both teams, even when the Spurs have a bad game, like, watching these games or Utah Warriors and then watching Celtics-Wizards, it's pretty stark. And I'm somebody that's defended the Eastern Conference a lot. Like, being up close and personal with this stuff, it feels very different from what I'm seeing in the Eastern Conference, where it's like, no, yeah, like, guys made a bunch of shots. Yeah.
But that's weird, because I don't, like, I get that same feeling watching the East, but it's not because I don't think they're executing an offense. To me, I'm like, where's the defense? Like, to me, in the Boston-Washington series, the whole thing has just been, like, these teams are getting open shots every time down.
Yeah.
Like, they're just, like, it's a shootout.
Yeah, the Wizards can still take the series. They Wall posted up Isaiah last night, and that worked. The biggest problem, I think, with some teams is they don't exploit these kind of things enough. They're always like, well, let's just run our offense. And it's like, no. Like, you should just be clearing everyone out and going to work on Isaiah Thomas. That's what you should be doing, because he's physically unable to do certain things. He is physically, it's impossible for him to do certain things. He played really well in game one. I thought defensively he got, like, they started to work on him a little bit more, but then they go away from it. You know, it's like they start to, and then it's like, oh, no, let's do this other thing. It's like, no, don't settle.
Well, I remember they gave it to Porter in the post, and Isaiah got a stop on him. Like, okay. I think there's something to be said for, like, having offensive flow and, like, letting your best players make plays rather than, you know, if he's marking Kelly Oubre or Otto Porter, like, I don't know that I just give it to those guys and see what happens.
No, I would be trying to target him in switches and things like that. Like, I would be trying to target him defensively every time down. Like, that would be my number one priority, would be to target him. And because you can hopefully pick up some level of foul. If the officials are ever going to get past this small dude thing, which is really absurd, and it's happening across the league. Like, it happens with Tony Parker, like, I'm sorry, you don't get credit for being small. And for some reason, the officials have always done this, where if you were a little guy, you're allowed to get away with whatever, and if you fall, it's automatically a foul. And I've never understood it. Like, I've just never gotten this. Like, why are we punishing players for being bigger? Why is that a bad thing? Like, why do the officials do that? I can't get my brain around it.
I don't think that it's a foul every time you fall. I've seen Isaiah take some, like, really hard hits in these playoffs that haven't been called. Like, I think on the other end, yeah, like, off the ball, like, when he is defending someone, he's, like, really physical and uses his hands. But also, I think, like, that is an issue around the league. Like, if you watch any of these teams, like, if you watch, like, the Jazz-Warriors game, like, both teams that are trying to have a ton of off-ball action, a ton of movement, and, like, all of their, like, wings and even point guards when they're off the ball. Like, they're running around and just being grabbed and held, and, like, very rarely is anything called. Like, the whole freedom of movement thing that we're supposed to have in the modern NBA, like, it's not there. It's there if you have the ball. It's not there if you're running around. And I think that's the thing that bugs me in the playoffs.
How many times are the officials going to fall for the Marcus Smart plays?
I mean, like, I don't know. Like, if they weren't, like, he'd stop doing it. Like, it's always been somewhat successful.
It's amazing, man. It's just amazing. Like, and this is I think this drives the executives I talk to. This drives them nuts too. Like, how you go back and you watch, so you know he's screwing with you. Like, you know he's making you look dumb, and yet they continue to call it anytime he falls. It's incredible. The Wizards started double flopping last night just to combat it. Double flops are my favorite thing in the entire world.
Double flops.
It's so amazing.
You do have to credit him for some of the plays he made, though. Like, aside from the flopping, like when
the
he
offensive
like,
rebound,
in for a couple
the offensive rebound, rebound was that was I mean that was one of the biggest plays of the game. If I wasn't writing about Isaiah last night because you had to like that needed to be commented on, I would have broken down how the hell he got that rebound.
There's another one too.
I like Marcin Gortat a lot. I think Marcin Gortat is underrated. I think Marcin Gortat does a lot of things that people don't appreciate. Marcin Gortat's really having problems in the series, and it's giving them real issues. They need Yamahimi back so bad. Like, Yamahimi,
I don't think Mahimi would do any better. Like, Gortat's issue is that he's not quick enough, and Mahimi's slower.
No, but Mahimi would help them with screens. Mahimi would help them. I think Mahimi would help them with rim protection. He's a deterrent more than Gortat is right now. Like, I think Mahimi would help them in notable ways.
Yeah, he's a better shot blocker,
and
yeah.
And the other thing is, realize how many, like, minutes that, like, Gortat played 41 minutes last night. 41.
Yeah, that's a lot to ask of him. Like,
that's a lot for a guy that
that's
big
a lot of, like,
age.
Pick and roll defense and rolling to the rim and, like, running the floor and dirty work. Like, that, like, his job is, like, really difficult and thankless, and it's, like, 41 minutes is a ton to ask for him.
And here's the thing. I think if you're the Wizards, you are encouraged because you're just like, look, we could have the game one, we lost Keefe. Game two, it went to overtime. We missed two good looks at the buzzer, and Bradley Beal went 4 of 15, and we lost an OT. Like,
yeah, I mean, some of it is like you're thinking, like, if Bradley Beal had like an average game,
right,
they probably would have won.
But
like, it's an average game,
but
a great one.
But on my end, I'm also like, you had opportunities and you lost them. And that may be the only opportunities that you get. So we'll see what happens. All right.
I do really like that series, though. Like, both of those games have been entertaining. They've been intense, a little weird, a little gory, which
yeah.
isn't necessarily.
God, that blood pouring out of Porter. Good Lord.
Yeah, that was nuts.
And then Keith throws Horford into the stands and, like,
Keith is just on edge 100% of the time, and it was like that in the first round too. And I don't know why I'm surprised, because like, he was like that when he played summer league for the Suns. Like, it's sort of like just what he's about, but it seems like it's dialed up a little extra in the playoffs.
And then it was funny though, because it was like, oh man, look at all these injuries, and I'm watching and I'm like, well, okay, the Wizards have been hit on accident, like a bunch in the face. Or, you know, Horford slides under Keith on that thing, which I do believe was an accident. And then, like,
how about when Isaiah hits his face on the floor?
Because he doesn't stop himself. Like, I was like, Isaiah, what are you doing? Like, like, he just, like, lands. I'm like, dude, you see the ground's coming. Put your hands up. Like, throws himself to the ground coming through that pick and lands up. And I'm like, you're going to lose a tooth. And then Smart falls backwards and smacks his head trying to flop. And I'm like, it felt like that scene in Liar Liar where it's like, what are you doing? I'm kicking my ass. That's what the Celtics are doing. What are your thoughts on Jazz Warriors? I'm just gonna let you go with Jazz Warriors.
What? Oh, I mean, the Jazz, they got the Warriors right where they want them. Just a perfect game one from Utah. What do you want me to say? Like, I don't know, man. Like, there was a certain point in like the second quarter when I was like, you know, I think the Jazz are playing fine, and I look at the score and I was like, oh, maybe this is them playing fine, and that's just the differential. But it was like a 15-16 point game at that point, and I was like, I don't know. Like, I think from a Utah perspective, like, the optimistic angle is like, yeah, it's the first game, and the Jazz just finished off the Clippers, and like, they weren't ready for this onslaught. But I don't know. Like, as great as the Jazz defense is, like, if their offense can't, like, get some buckets when the Warriors are, like, rattling off these like, runs, like, I think if you're giving up, like, 11-0 runs against the Warriors, like, it's really difficult to, like, stay in the game. Like, you can, if you answer with, like, a bucket or two when the Warriors get hot, then you can kind of survive and stay in it and just hang around and try to slow it down at the end and beat them. But, like, there were stretches.
I kind of figured it out because I was thinking about, because you were like, they have shooters when we were doing our kind of preview talk. And I was talking to a front office person today, and I noted that I was like, it's not that they don't have efficient shooters. They don't have explosive scorers. And that's their problem, is Utah doesn't have explosive scorers. They have nobody that's just going to be like a boom, 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 rattle off. Like, Gordon Hayward is one of those dudes that's going to, like, pick up. Like, he's going to steadily increase throughout the game. It's going to be like he had six, and then six, and then six, and then five. And have, like, good games. He had a bad one in game one. That's understandable. It's a tough matchup. He gets to have bad nights. He's been sick all week. It's understandable. But, like, they don't have anybody that's just – like, George Hill is not going to be like, oh, man, George Hill, 18 in the quarter. That's not happening. Like, Joe Ingles is not going to be like, oh, Joe Ingles again. He's got 12 in the quarter. That's not happening.
Rodney Hood is probably – I mean, Rodney Hood and Joe are the two guys that do that.
Yeah, and Joe –
and you know what? Like, Gordon Hayward, I think, can do that, but I don't think he's doing that against Andre Iguodala.
Right.
Or against Kevin Durant.
Right.
Like, I just don't see that.
And, like...
And there are things that Jazz can do to, like, try to be creative and try to put him in more advantageous situations where he's not going one-on-one against an amazing defender. But I don't see, like, what you're talking about. Like, I don't see Gordon Hayward at any point in the series just being like, I am taking over one-on-one now. Because it's just too hard against that defense. Like, the only way that happens is if they're getting stops on the other end and they're, like, pushing the ball, but it's like the Jazz so rarely do that anyway, even when they get stops. Like, they run less than any other team in the league. They're amazing when they do. Like, if you look at the synergy numbers, they're like the best transition offense team in the league, but that's because they only do it when they have a sure bucket.
Yeah.
And they choose to push the pace.
Here's a good example. Imagine, and this, he's not even an explosive scorer, but he's kind of a different kind of dude. Like, imagine if Joe Ingles was coming off the bench and Danny Green was starting, and you had George Hill and Danny Green. And then you had Gobert and all those guys. Like, Danny Green would be able to give you, like, high-level defense and, like, spot-up crack shooting, you know? And, like, Ingles is an efficient shooter, but he's never going to be, like...
He shot 44% the regular season from three. Like, he was, like, I think third or fourth in the league.
Okay. I understand.
Like,
we're not arguing efficiency. Like, that's not what I'm not trying to argue percentages. Like, they all have very nice percentages, and that's terrific for them. But, like, he averaged 3.4 three-point attempts per game.
Yeah, he's not just launching them. That's, like, he's a guy that had to be encouraged to shoot. Like, he always wants to pass.
Yes.
Him and Diao are similar.
So that's what I'm trying to get at. Because I was thinking about it, and I was like, well, no, James is right. Like, they have a lot of efficient shooters. And I was like, it's not about efficiency. I was like, it's really not. Like, efficiency is really important. You don't get to the playoffs if you're not efficient. But you have to have some level of explosiveness to your game to a degree. Like, Danny Green is never going to be like Kawhi or like Klay Thompson, but Danny Green will be like, wow, he hit two big threes in that quarter, you know? And like...
Yeah, or in like 30 seconds sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the differential that would like at least lean them in that kind of direction. So, I mean, I think that I feel pretty comfortable with what I first said about the series, which is Utah just doesn't have the firepower. Because maybe nobody does. You know, and that is a very real possibility. That's not about the Jazz, because we wind up making every series a conversation about if one team is losing and the other team is better, we make it a conversation about what that team doesn't have. And the reality with this is, you know, maybe Utah would be up 1-0 on Houston. Maybe Utah would have done the same thing to San Antonio that Houston
right.
did. We don't know. We do know, though, that the Warriors are definably better than every other team in this league. And you can't really evaluate how good or bad or limited or explosive or anything any team is versus Golden State. And the fact that this is becoming so apparent game by game in the playoffs is why so many of us are like, the finals are over. Like, and I know that everyone's going to say, like, we thought that last year. I get it. I do. This does not feel like last year. Like, last year it really was like, oh my God, the Warriors are just the best team that we've ever seen, and there's no way Cleveland can keep up. I mean, yeah, sure, they've got all these good things going for them. And now this year we're like, no, no, the Warriors are incredible. Maybe not as magical as they were last year, but they're incredible, and Cleveland's a little bit worse, and everybody else is behind them. It just, it, the gap feels bigger. And I don't know... I don't. You said that you think that this team is better than the ones that they've had in the past, and I don't know about that. I'm not sure, but I do know that they're playing their best ball right now, and it just seems impossible for me to find any scenario where anybody's able to hang with Golden State, which is, quite frankly, I will say, like, that's not good for the league. It's one thing if a team wins all the time. I don't know if it's good for the league for no one to have a chance. I don't know if it's good for you to be able to talk yourself into it, because at least with the Bulls, you could be like, the Knicks have a good team, and the, you know, and the Sonics have a good team, and the Jazz have a good team, and the Magic and Shaq, and you could talk yourself into these things even when you were like Michael Jordan. The Warriors, mm-hmm. I don't know what you tell yourself. I don't know how you talk yourself into there anyone having a chance.
Yeah, I still want to see how things play out, and like even in this series, I want to see what happened when the Jazz execute their game plan better. And look, like, it might be the case where even if the Jazz play a perfect game, like, they're relying on the Warriors just missing shots, like, to make it close. Like, I don't know what the Jazz's best against the Warriors totally looks like. I can kind of picture it, and I think, like, when we talked about it previewing the series, I think it would sort of look like when we saw Memphis slow the Warriors down, and when we saw OKC do it, and Cleveland kind of, and the Jazz are very different style of team than Cleveland, but I'm talking about more the Cleveland from a couple of years ago, when they played really slow, in the first finals matchup. And I think, yeah, in the big picture, the Warriors are still the massive favorites, and it would take something going horrifically wrong, for anybody to frame it a different way. But that to me doesn't, like, it doesn't make any of this not interesting. Like, I still want to see what happens. I still want to see, how the Warriors do this. And, like, look, I predicted the Jazz to take a couple games in the series, but also, like, before the playoffs started, I wrote in one piece, I don't remember what it was, but, like, there's a non-zero possibility they just sweep the whole playoffs and go 16-0. Like, that's how good this team is. Like, the ceiling is that high. And I don't think we should be shocked if they make really good teams and great teams look average, because that's just the kind of roster that they have, and specifically the style they played with, like the explosiveness factor that you talked about. Like, they can just take a game that looks like it's close, and then, like, in 2 minutes suddenly it isn't, and it's really hard to recover from that against a team that talented and a team that's, like, that good at defense. But yeah, like I said, like that doesn't really affect how I watch, like, Wiz Celtics, and like how excited I am about, like, Isaiah, or how I watch, like, any of the other series. Like, that, I'm still into all of this.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I think I have different people in my life than you do, because I'm getting a lot of comments from family and friends and other casual observers, and our editor among them, who's actually a Warriors fan, about how pointless all of this feels. Like, there actually is, like, my dad texted me and is just like, what's the point? Like, what? Like, is there any point to any of this? Like, aren't the Warriors just going to beat everybody? I'm like, yeah, they are. He's like, couldn't you come home? And I was, you know, I'm like, well, I think this, you know, the story is interesting how we get there, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to cover this series, is because I think there's a lot of interesting things about both teams and Spurs Rockets. Like, that, this series feels like it has weight. Jazz Warriors does not feel like it has weight. It does not feel like an important matchup that will say many things. And I think that there is a sense from some people, and I asked a question last night on Twitter. You know, if you're not in the Bay and you're not in Utah, do you care about this game? And the reason I asked it was, even if you like the Warriors, you know they're going to win, right? Like, even if you're like, oh, I really want to see the Warriors, like, you would wait for the conference finals matchup between, you know, Houston or San Antonio and them, and be like, oh, I'm really excited about that game. Because, like, this one, it just feels like, no, I mean, I know it's going to happen. You know, and you, to your credit, are very much like, well, this and this other thing, and they have the style and are very much in the weeds. And I'm trying to find like a balance between the big picture and the small picture to get a sense of how important these games are. Because that's the kind of thing is you could say like, well, you know, no series matters except the finals in that sense, because that's the only one that determines the champion. If we're going to say that that's the end point, it just feels so much like Golden State is so much better than everyone else because of their roster, which does a disservice to their style of play and willingness to buy into the system. But it feels so much like they are so much better that there's I'm fine with it because like I've never liked dominance, but I've gotten to a point where I'm like I just accept it. I was like, that's the most likely outcome. That's okay. There's other interesting things. Like there's really interesting things. Like, you know, this, like I said, the Spurs Rockets series is interesting. The winner of Celtics Wizards is that's a really interesting story because either the Wizards came and kind of like had a better playoff roster than thought of, and John Wall kind of establishes himself, or, you know, the Celtics really have a chance to put something amazing together and take a finals contender and then add to it. And that's really relevant. But overall, we keep coming back to how do you, even if you know that nothing is sure, like even if 3-1 taught us nothing is sure and probability is not inevitability, how do you really deal day to day as a sports fan if you're a fan of the NBA with this encompassing knowledge that Golden State is certifiably better by several degrees than even the best teams? And how does that impact how you enjoy or watch the game? These are questions I think are actually interesting, and they're more interesting than watching Gordon Hayward get bludgeoned to death on national television. Like, that's the thing, is that game last night, is it just like, okay, another three, he pulled up in transition, three, Steph Curry dribbled around for 45 seconds and made a layup, all right, okay, again.
You didn't like that play against Gobert, where he made him turn around?
That's just not...
And then he went in with the English off the glass?
I'm stupid, because, like, I get excited about, like, ridiculous, like, not as fun things. Like, I get excited about I get excited about really good screens. Like, I get excited about, like... About like an incredible corner pass. Like I love post like passing from the high post. Like those are the things that really amaze me. I'm excited for a Celtics Warriors series in which Isaiah Thomas and Steph Curry dribble around for 45 seconds for like 40 minutes of the game. It'll be amazing. But like, you know, I don't know. To me, those questions about how do you experience the NBA right now with the Warriors are actually kind of more interesting on a macro scale than Warriors Jazz is on a micro.
Yeah. See, I mean, I could like, if I had, I could talk about the Jazz for like 45, like we could do a whole podcast about the Jazz and I'd be into it. Like that's where I am, but I'm a little weird.
The ratings for that one, I mean, our downloads would be through the roof.
Hey man, we should do this, like, every time a team gets eliminated from now on, I think, because we're now all talking about like really good teams, I think we should do a postmortem on every team. I want to do the Jazz one. I want to know how many people listen to it.
Now that the Bulls are out, and you don't have to talk about them for an entire episode, you're willing to do these recaps.
Hey, I would actually gladly do that. There's Bulls news today.
There is Bulls news today. That's a mess.
Do you want to cover that?
The only thing I will say is that they made a lot of there were comments in there about style of play and about how Jimmy Butler doesn't adapt to like the pace that they need to play. Like, go get him, teams. Like, go get Jimmy Butler. Go get Paul George. Go rescue these individuals and add them to your squads.
I did a triple take when I saw that quote about Butler. I'm just like, do you not care about him at all?
But they've been doing this, right? The thing that they've broadcast, I will say this, the thing that they broadcast under the wire, this is the sense around the league, and maybe it's not 100% accurate, but this is what multiple people around the league have told me, is that the Bulls have been frustrated because they feel like they didn't really think that Butler was going to be that good. And then he got that good, and you know how we talked about Isaiah Thomas and how everyone's like, is he really this good? That's how the Bulls feel about Jimmy Butler, is they're constantly like, was he really this good? They don't really like his leadership. They don't really like his attitude, and his game doesn't like spark what they want, which is amazing because it's just like Jimmy Butler's like a like.
So fine, you don't deserve Jimmy Butler. Trade him then.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. I think I've definitely gotten a whiff like all season of like them regretting that they didn't take the Celtics package at the draft last year, and now it seems like maybe they won't get an offer as good as that again. But I mean, for his sake, honestly, at this point, for the Bulls' sake, like they've created such a mess that it might honestly be easier to rebuild without him. And I say that knowing full well, like, the idea of trading someone that good on a contract that good just seems insane for any team. But we're at the point where I'm just like, fine, whatever, just do it. Just get rid of him. Just get whatever you can back. Get as many draft picks and good players as you can and build a, like, pace and space team, whatever. Like, give Hoiberg the pieces that, like, are young and can shoot and, like, do that. Like, just pick a direction. And if that direction somehow includes Rajon Rondo, which would confuse the hell out of me, then sure, whatever. Do what you want. Just, like, do your thing, Chicago. I'm beyond caring about, like, their big picture plan at this point. And it's like, I think Jimmy Butler's a great player. I want to see him surrounded by really good players and guys that actually fit next to him and make him better, and then he makes them better. And I've kind of given up hope that that's going to happen there.
Who would he help the most?
Like a contending team? Like, he has the type of game that honestly I think can help any team. Like, I mean, he's not an amazing spot-up shooter, but, like, he's so versatile and so good defensively that I think he fits pretty much anywhere. Like, what situations were you thinking of? Like, I wonder if they could trade him for, like, C.J. McCollum and stuff.
We're going long.
And, like, put him next to Damian Lillard.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going long, but let's kind of run it down. Okay, Phoenix doesn't make sense. The Lakers... What if the Lakers liquidated all of their young assets and tried to get George and Jimmy Butler? Could they play together?
Sure. And that would be terrifying. Like, there would be no better defensive wing combo and offensive wing combo in the league.
Okay, so that's an option. The Wolves, obviously, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Unless they really did want to move on from... Well, I guess...
I mean, I think you could get Levine.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can get Wiggins, but you can get Levine, I think.
I mean, Levine's coming off the injury, but what if you got Levine, Jang, and a pick?
I mean, if I'm the Wolves, I'd do that.
If you're the Bulls?
If I'm the Wolves, I'd do that. I don't know if I do it if I'm the Bulls.
No,
but...
I'm asking. If you're the Bulls, do you do that?
I don't know.
The Kings don't really make sense. Dallas, I think they'd have to give up the pieces that you need if you're bringing in Butler, so it doesn't make sense. Like... If you're bringing in Butler, you need to keep Barnes and you need to keep Noel, and that's the two pieces that they have to trade, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
New Orleans doesn't make sense. They don't have the money. Denver's going to call, you know, like they'll offer like Gary Harris, Moutier if you want him, Will Barton, and probably a pick. But you're not getting Jokic.
Isn't Barton a free agent or no?
No. He's next year.
Okay.
You're getting... If you call Denver, you're not getting Jokic and you're not getting Murray. Those are the two guys you're not getting. Anybody else you can get.
But you can take your pick for the rest. Yeah.
And I don't think that necessarily makes Denver better because their offense is entirely built on ball movement and it doesn't make any sense to add Jimmy Butler if you're all about ball movement. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, don't do that. And that's not like a knock on Butler. It's okay for guys to be ball dominant. You can win with ball dominant guys. You just... It's just not... That's why Paul George is really interesting. I talked to a few people this week around the league, and they all kind of said the same thing, which is our team has to be the right fit for Jimmy Butler versus we feel like Paul George will go anywhere. Like, you can use Paul George anywhere, and you feel comfortable that he'll just be like, I'll come off screens and shoot, and it's fine. Like, Paul George is not a I-need-the-ball guy. And that's why I think he's more valuable to teams.
Yeah, I mean, that might be the case at this point. It's weird, because, like, I see... Like, their games are very similar, but there are a few key differences, and it's like, what does your team need? Like, if they need another guy to play, like, de facto point guard, then I'd actually want Butler, which is interesting because up until this year, like, you would have said Paul George was the better offensive player, the better creator, but I'm not sure that's the case anymore. But if you want someone to fit in and play with other stars on offense, then, like, George is, like... Maybe you see him as a guy that can fit in better, that, like, plays better with others. But I would also say that, like, Butler keeps getting better year after year. Like, this was the best year of his career statistically, and he keeps making strides in areas where, quite frankly, he, like, wasn't good at all when he came into the league. Like, the stuff that George does that Butler doesn't, I don't want to say, like, Butler can't be good at that either.
I think he is ball dominant. I think he's more comfortable with the ball in his hands. For me, it's like the Melo thing, but my whole thing with Melo has always been, if he would just try on defense, I don't care what he does. Like, it's fine for you to be ball dominant if you just, as long as you try hard on defense, and Melo does not do that.
Right.
The ideal would be Memphis. Like, flat out. Memphis.
I mean, that would be amazing.
If
there's no way to get him
No,
there,
there's
though.
No way. There's no way. Unless the Bulls were really like, no, we think Chandler Parsons is going to get healthy. We like Chandler Parsons. You give us Chandler Parsons and Wade Baldwin and two first-round picks, and then Memphis would be like, done. Done deal. Yeah. And then you have Mike Conley and Jimmy Butler and Marc Gasol, and you're never scoring again. No one is scoring on them ever, except the Warriors, who would still beat them. OKC's not that.
Clippers fans are thinking we want to sign and trade with Blake Griffin. That's what they're thinking, but I don't know that you're talking Blake Griffin into doing that.
Yeah, OKC would obviously be ideal, but you're never going to get you're never going to get Chicago to be like, yeah, we'll take Cantor and whatever. That's not going to happen.
No.
Utah doesn't make sense unless Gordon leaves. The Clippers we talked about. The Rockets will not want him. The Spurs don't make a lot of sense, I guess. You could. I mean, hey, if you have Jimmy Butler and Kawhi Leonard, wait, hey, hang on. What if you did LaMarcus for him? No, I'm serious.
But why do the Bulls want, like? I mean, I guess the Bulls are fond of like 30-plus-year-old guys with big names. So maybe I shouldn't dismiss it.
Former All-Star LaMarcus Aldridge.
I mean, to me, if you're trading Butler, you need youth.
You get a pick, and you get DeJounte Murray. You know what's funny? The Spurs might honestly say no. The Spurs might honestly say no because of DeJounte Murray.
I don't think that's the case, but I mean, I think they are high on Murray.
The Warriors should trade for him. That's still...
Sure.
Everyone else is going there. We'll just add him on there, and he can take Iguodala's spot. They'll do a sign-and-trade for Iguodala. Yeah, and in the East, there are no good enough teams. They're deserving of him. okay, well...
I mean, the Raptors do need somebody to guard LeBron.
Well, I was going there. Okay, I'll ask you this. DeRozan for Jimmy Butler. Who says no?
I mean, I think the Bulls say no, probably. Like, that DeRozan contract is enormous.
That's interesting, though. Ooh, I kind of like this.
I don't know.
You get,
like, that's a tricky deal to do. Like, just, it's a tricky deal to make work, because there has to be other pieces involved.
The Bulls hate threes. DeMar DeRozan is like their perfect star. This is a good idea.
I mean, I don't know how realistic this idea is.
Hang on, I can figure this out.
Yeah, I would say Toronto does need somebody like that.
The money differential isn't that big. You only have to get to, you gotta remember, you gotta get to 150%. Dude, Butler and Mirotić for DeRozan works.
Does that work next year, though, when DeRozan's contract is even higher? Actually, they structured that weird. That might not even be the case. I'm not looking at the contract
this
details
is doable.
Right now.
We need to make this happen. Jimmy Butler to the Raptors. Fred Hoiberg.
Every
to
podcast
DeRozan.
We do somehow has to end up with DeRozan as like a centerpiece. And that, now you're moving him from the Raptors.
You want to actually, because of the feedback from people that are very mad at me online about the pod. I'm thinking about seriously doing an like in appreciation of DeMar DeRozan. Like I may not do it in the playoffs because I don't think I'm going to have time, but I think in the offseason I'm going to do like I did with Harden. I did like a huge Harden breakdown over before the season started. I think I'm going to do that with DeRozan
to prove to people that you don't hate him.
Yeah, to showcase like how good he is, and I'll talk about his weaknesses too, but like to really show like the things that he does really great.
Sure.
So
if you want to, I won't stop you.
We should do that. We should take a month and we'll flip, and like I'll do like an appreciation of DeMar DeRozan and write about like,
and I'll do like I'll extol the virtues of the 2016-17 Chicago Bulls.
Right. Well, you can just be really sarcastic and negative about everything, and that way we'll just flip it. Like I'll write about how this young player is better than you think he is, and like you can question like whether or not anyone over 6'4 is really should even be paid in the league. We'll just flip it. We'll just trade these things. I had my first good meal down on the Riverwalk today.
What'd you have?
And I don't mean that on this trip. I mean ever. I've never had a good meal on the Riverwalk. There's a place that a friend sent me called, what was it, Bruno? Something like that? Bordeaux. Yeah. Bordeaux. That's what it was. And it was excellent. It was, I had like a really great salad. It was by the Riverwalk. It was the first one that was really terrific. The secret was San Antonio. So, you know, the Riverwalk is not dirty. That's a lie. Like the Riverwalk is a very clean, nice area. Chuck's being ridiculous about that. I don't like the Riverwalk because it's just basically like a tourist trap. It's just like it's just overpriced margaritas, which I don't drink anyway. My own drink margaritas specifically.
I just looked up this place. Did you mean Boudreaux's?
Boudreaux's, yes.
Okay.
It's very good. And it was excellent. I highly recommend it. It was, I had a really great lunch down there, but there's a lot to like.
Ribeye sandwich. Give me that.
It was nice. It was nicer than I thought it was. It was enjoyable. The Riverwalk itself is pretty, but everything down there is overpriced. San Antonio, though, I've really gotten to love. Like when I lived in Austin, I did not appreciate San Antonio. I called it the mini mall of Texas. And I've been down here for like 4 out of 5 years. I've gotten to really like this place. Like I dig San Antonio. Good people. What's funny is I've gotten to really like AT&T Center, even though it's this impossible labyrinth that has animals scattered throughout it. It really is. Like I cannot.
Have you seen any bats?
I have not, but I bet that they're there.
Snakes? Like,
I will say this, all of the tunnels are very narrow. And they're labyrinthine. Like, you can get lost in there very easily. I've gotten lost, even on this trip, even though I know my way around, like, 3 times. Getting lost in the labyrinth underneath AT&T Center. But it's got, like, this own charm to it. I really have gotten to kind of appreciate it. And I'm writing this today. Popovich has been so nice. I'm not kidding. He's been joking and laughing and, like, messing with reporters and hasn't been a jerk at all.
Maybe you can get to have some wine with them.
I've been chasing a bottle of Rock and Hammer, his select private label, and two people have offered me them. They're like, I have a bottle. Do you want one? I'm like, no. Well, because I have to get it from, like, I have to have it from somebody that's gotten, it can't be like a random one-off. Like, I have to acquire it.
What do you mean? You know how rare those things are. If you can get one, you got to take it.
There are many people I would take one from. I worked George Carl for a year trying to get one, and he still wouldn't give me one. Like I told George Carl has a case of it. He has a case of it, and I asked him. I was like, "Well, how does it taste?" Hint, hint. And he was like, "Well, I don't have taste buds anymore since the cancer." He's like, "So I can't really enjoy it anymore." And then like he's telling me this. I'm like, "You can't even enjoy it."
But you couldn't quite say, give me it, George.
I can't ask for it.
Give me the wine.
I can't be like, hey, George Carl, give me a bottle of this very select wine that Greg Popovich only gives to people that he really cares about or auctions off for charity. I can't do it. Can't do it.
Okay.
I have asked him what to pair with it. I know what to pair with it if I ever get a bottle. Like, I have to do a salmon dish, which I don't even like salmon, but I would do just for this wine.
I was going to say, like, what if you don't like salmon? Like, all right.
All right. Anyway, so that's James Herbert. We'll be covering all the games tonight. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about how much the Raptors lost by. You can find him at Outside the NBA. I'm at Matt Moore, CBS. Thanks for listening.